Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 1, Text Number 7. Prayena Munayo Rajan Nivritta Vidhi Sedataha Nairagunya Sta Ramante Sma Gunanukatani Harehe Prayena Munayo Rajan Nivritta Vidhi Sedataha Nairgunyastaramantesma Gunhanukatani Hare Prayena, mainly Munaya, all sages Rajan, O king Nivrittaha, above Vidhi, regulative principles Sedataha, from restrictions. Nairagunyastaha, transcendentally situated. Ramante, take pleasure in. Sma, distinctly. Guna anukatane, describing the glories. Harehe, of the Lord. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. O King Parikshit, mainly the topmost transcendentalists, who are above the regulative principles and restrictions, take pleasure in describing the glories of the Lord. Purport. The topmost transcendentalist is a liberated soul, and is therefore not within the purview of the regulative principles. A neophyte who is intended to be promoted to the spiritual plane is guided by the spiritual master under regulative principles. He may be compared to a patient who is treated by various restrictions under medical jurisdiction. Generally, liberated souls also take pleasure in describing the transcendental activities. As mentioned above, since Narayana, Hari, the personality of Godhead is beyond the material creation, His form and attributes are not material. The topmost transcendentalists, or the liberated souls, realize Him by advanced experience of transcendental knowledge, and therefore they take pleasure in the discussion of the transcendental qualities of the Lord's pastimes. In the Bhagavad Gita 4.9, the personality of Godhead declares that His appearance and His activities are all dibhyam, or transcendental. The common man who is under the spell of material energy takes it for granted that the Lord is like one of us, and therefore he refuses to accept the transcendental nature of the Lord's form, name, etc. The topmost transcendentalist is not interested in anything material, and his taking interest in the matter of the Lord's activities is definite proof that the Lord is not like one of us in the material world. In the Vedic literature also, it is confirmed that the Supreme Lord is one, but that He is engaged in His transcendental pastimes in the company of His unalloyed devotees, and that simultaneously He is present as a supersoul, an expansion of Baladev in the heart of all living entities. Therefore, the highest perfection of transcendental realization is to take pleasure in hearing and describing the transcendental qualities of the Lord, and not in merging into the impersonal Brahman existence, for which the impersonalist monist aspires. Real transcendental pleasure is realized in the glorification of the transcendental Lord and not in the feeling of being situated in his impersonal feature. But there are also others who are not the topmost transcendentalists, but are in a lower status, and who do not take pleasure in describing the transcendental activities of the Lord. Rather, they discuss such activities of the Lord formally with the aim of merging into his existence. This statement of Sukadeva Goswami is a response to the essential question of Maharaj Parikshit, namely, what is the most important thing for one to do at the end of one's life? Everybody's life will eventually come to its final conclusion, and all that we have done will come to the final moment of our consciousness. At that point, whatever our consciousness is will determine what our next birth is. And therefore, the final moment is all important. Maharaj Parikshit appears to have been unfortunate for having been cursed to die. And so many misfortunes may also turn out, as his did, to not be a misfortune. Because getting notice prior to one's death of when one will die and how one will die allows one to prepare perfectly for that final moment. We see that even a little bit of advancement in Krishna consciousness can protect one at the most dangerous time. So many devotees who were not able to apparently follow the practices of Krishna consciousness perfectly were nevertheless given notice of when their end would come. And so they prepared themselves. They became very serious, grave, began to chant more sincerely and intently, constantly kept association with devotees, and were able to give up their bodies in a glorious manner. Therefore, a little bit of advancement can protect one even at the most difficult times. We do not necessarily appreciate, we don't always appreciate the wonderful benefit we are getting from this Krishna consciousness process. But at the final moment, we will actually understand how fortunate it is that we have taken to this process. So the king asked that question, and in the previous verse, Sukadeva Goswami told him about various ways to prepare oneself for that final moment. He said the highest perfection of life, human life, achieved either by complete knowledge of matter and spirit, by practice of mystic powers, or by perfect discharge of occupational duty, is to remember the personality of Godhead at the end of life. So there are various paths which are open to us. But all of these paths must lead to one goal. And that goal is described, janma karma che me dibyam yovam veti tattvataha tepta deham punar janma naiti mam eti so arjuna. If you want to be certain that you are not going to be born again in this material world, then at the final moment of death you have to recall the transcendental appearance and activities of the Lord. Now, how you come to that stage, Sukadeva Goswami describes a number of processes. He says, you can do so by complete knowledge of matter and spirit. And this, after all, is what real knowledge is. Knowledge which only describes matter but ignores spirit is not full knowledge. And knowledge which only describes spirit but ignores matter is also incomplete. Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu presented his philosophy of inconceivable, simultaneous one and difference. Matter and spirit are one, because they are ultimately the energy of the Lord. Yet they are functioning differently. One is creating separation, the experience of separation from the Lord, whereas the other is bringing us closer to the Lord. To confuse matter and spirit is philosophically damaging, and it will be practically damaging. If one, for example, sees everything as spirit, then many different results accrue. One will not think that one has to make any effort to get out of this material world because one will think that one is already in spiritual life. Two, one will think that all of one's activities are spiritual, just like we see so many persons, so-called spiritualists. For example, they may try to sacramentalize sex, saying everything is spiritual. So this is also spiritual. They may do so many things of this sort. So in this way, they can interpret all material things as spiritual, even the grossest of material things. On the other hand, someone who cannot distinguish matter from spirit and sees everything as matter, just like in material science, persons who are reductionists bring everything down to the point of atoms or something even more tiny and insignificant without seeing anything spiritual. So they're also missing the full truth. So to distinguish matter from spirit is real knowledge, but to understand that both have their connection with God. Then, by practice of mystic powers, this is another way. But what is the source of mysticism? Mystic powers are yoga siddhis. Ultimately, the best use of a yoga siddhi is to transfer oneself to the abode of the Supreme Lord. Because one can travel in any direction one chooses if one has mystic power. But sometimes that is misused. We see yogis have great powers, and they abuse these powers for personal aggrandizement. But it could be used to transfer oneself to the abode of the Supreme Lord. And discharge of occupational duty. Again, we are reminded in the Bhagavatam that if you only discharge your occupational duty, but you neglect to develop a taste for hearing the transcendental narrations of the Lord, you have simply wasted your life. Now, this Varnashram Dharma, still to some extent, the vestige of it remains in the minds of many in India. And they pride themselves in being able to fulfill various worldly duties. But if they don't have an attraction for hearing of Krishna's transcendental narrations, what is the use? Certainly, no one is able to perform Varnashram Dharma perfectly in the Kali Yuga. If one was able to do so, and if one could take 100 births and execute Varnashram Dharma perfectly, then all that you would get from that is that you could take your next birth in the next universal creation as a Brahma. That's what you get from the perfect performance of Varnashram Dharma. And why does it say it leads to the glorification of the Lord? Because just as with mystic yoga, and just with the understanding of Jnana Yoga, of knowledge and spirit, if it is guided properly, it will lead to Krishna. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was discussing with Ramananda Roy, he rejected Varnashram Dharma as the highest type of activity. But it is supportive. It can be helpful. And with proper guidance, it can be used to come to a higher state of being. At least it will pacify the senses and mind. That's the purpose of Varnashram Dharma. Apart from letting society function peacefully, it allows the individual to function peacefully. For example, if someone is too agitated by sexual desires, and if they get married, then through the marriage yajna, the sacrifice of marriage, their senses and mind will get pacified. They can chant Hare Krishna peacefully. Now, in this verse, Sukadev Goswami comes to the final point, which is to glorify the Lord. And he says, transcendentalists, topmost transcendentalists, sounds like the Atmarama verse, Atmaramas Chamunayo. And what do the Atmaramas do? They also... That verse also describes how they take pleasure in hearing the narrations of the Lord. These verses are warnings, and as you can see, Prabhupada follows the line of thinking that is given in the Atmarama verse. These verses are words of warning about what transcendental perfection is. Transcendental perfection is not to merge into the existence of the Lord, monism. There is a great threat from monism. Otherwise, Srila Prabhupada would not have declared it to be his mission to overturn monism, impersonalism, voidism, if it were not such an attraction. Because in the present day and age, people have lost sight of the personality of Godhead. It doesn't matter what religion you investigate, you will find people have lost sight of the personality of Godhead. Still, they're personalists. They are personalists, but on a mundane platform, generally. No one is satisfied with simply being impersonal. At least very few are. Prabhupada points out that one social organization in India which goes under the heading of a religious name usually performs welfare activity by opening hospitals. Prabhupada's point is that although they advocate impersonal monistic meditation, when it finally comes down to day-to-day activities, they're engaged in helping people. Worldly welfare work. Why? Because it gives some personal satisfaction. Similarly, we see very often when we lecture and we meet people who try to espouse the philosophy of Shankara, that they don't live the life of Shankara. They don't live an impersonal life. They have their families, their wives or perhaps husbands or children or parents, and they're very devoted to all of these worldly engagements. Now, if actually they believe in the philosophy that all is one, that everything is simply a product of Maya, and that Maya doesn't really have any substantial existence, it's just an illusion, a figment of the mind, everyone is actually one, and that one is Brahman, then why are they living such a lie? Why are they living in contradiction to their philosophy? This is very important. We have to judge a philosophy by how well it can be lived. Actions speak louder than words. It's no use to talk high philosophy and live in a different way. So we have to see how far our philosophy is actually able to be translated into day-to-day occurrences. Now, in the world of theology, this is a major consideration. You see? In terms of modern theology, many people feel that it's no longer useful to follow the doctrines or the models which were formerly followed by past theologians, because they believe that scientific discoveries require that doctrine and models be adjusted. For example, it is not found that creation has stopped. There's continuous creation going on all the time. So a model which says that there was once creation in 7 days and then everything stopped, which is what it says in the Bible, that for 7 days God created the heavens and the earth and everything was good and then it stopped, that kind of model isn't going to work because creation has been going on. There's development of new species, for example, or new varieties of species. Even if you say it's by artificial means, by genetic engineering, they can do it. So something somehow or other, even within our own presence, we see creation is going on. So you have to have a doctrine which will explain that. If you just depend upon a doctrine which doesn't explain it, then people lose faith. At least thoughtful people will lose faith. They want to see that everything can be reconciled, which is interesting because Prabhupada also wanted to see this. I had an experience to be with Prabhupada the final year of Prabhupada's pastimes. And I can tell you that the primary concern, the foremost concern that Prabhupada had regarding preaching was our BI, Bhaktivedanta Institute. He considered the Bhaktivedanta Institute preaching to be the most serious or the most forefront, attack frontal attack of our preaching mission. Why? Because today, the scientists are the gurus, basically. Although, you know, popular gurus are also sports heroes and politicians, movie stars. I don't think we can simply say that scientists are gurus. But, you know, they sort of, I think people of intelligence pretty much categorize different types of gurus. I mean, in other words, they may have their guru for when they're in a relaxed mode. That guru may be the sports hero or the, you know, the entertainer. And, you know, for social action, they may have their, you know, political guru. But when it comes to talking about reality, then the scientists, or if not the hard scientists, both the hard scientists and social sciences, you know, they take over. They're the gurus. And they say what reality is, because what does a guru do? A guru describes reality. So these scientists describe reality as they understand it to be. And there are consequences to what they say. For example, if you describe that reality is simply matter, no spirit, there's consequences to that. If everything is simply matter, then it may matter not, what you do in terms of long-range ethical consequences. Then you have to come up with a philosophy that explains how people should still be ethical, even though, you know, there is no God as a source of ethics. Even though there is no soul, which ultimately has to accept the results of good or bad actions. If there's no soul, and if there's no judge, God who is a judge, then what is to prevent someone from, you know, being unethical? This is the kind of concerns that people have today, you see. Because they haven't found God by scientific investigation. They can't find him. They can't find the soul by scientific. They've gotten as far as they can out into space, and God is nowhere to be found. And they've gotten into the body as far as they can, down to, you know, things which can't even be seen. I mean, beyond the size of the atom, they go still further to the point where they don't see a soul. And therefore, many of them conclude, no soul, no God. Now, you know, obviously, there's problems with this type of investigation. Ataha Sri Krishna Namadi. Not Bhagavad, not Gayam, not Bhavet Gayam Indrai. You can't see. You can't see Krishna with your blunt material senses. That's going to be a problem. That will be a problem. So Prabhupada recognized this problem. And therefore he requested the Bhaktivedanta Institute, you must explain our philosophy, that means our theology, in scientific terms. You have to convince the leaders of the world today. Now, we may not have a problem. We can have no problem. We are faithful people. We come through the doors. We bow down. We believe that the deity is Krishna. We believe that the holy name is not different than Krishna. We believe that following this practice will take us back to Godhead. But there's only 50, 75 people sitting in this room today. And there's 2 or 3 million people living in the greater Dallas area who don't believe it. So if we're going to make them believe it, we're going to have to explain it in terms which they can understand. And we can't compromise our philosophy. If you see what most religions have done, they feel that there's no alternative but to adjust the philosophy. And they make major adjustments. Major adjustments in their theologies to keep it up to date. They don't believe, for example, that Scripture is inerrant. Inerrant means without mistake. They believe that Scripture is a result of, you know, it's a result of a culture. It came out of a particular culture. It's dated. So, for example, what we read about in terms of interactions between men and women, it may have referred to a previous time, but it doesn't refer. It's not reasonable any longer. And similarly, when it describes a universe, as the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam does, it says that was tied into a particular worldview, which astronomy today has disproved. Now, Prabhupada was very hard line. When asked, did they go to the moon? Prabhupada said, no. Now, whether it was a physical planet or not that he was talking about, he said no. What he meant to say, what he did say, is they didn't go to the moon. And what he meant by that is, I have read about the moon, civilization, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and it talks about advanced beings. Since you say you went to somewhere which was uninhabited, you didn't go to the moon. What I call the moon, that place you did not go to. Now, where is that place? Or, if it's the same place, why is it that they have found nothing up there? Now, we can just keep saying they didn't go. We can't say that. Or we may have to explain, as Sataputta Prabhu has tried to explain, they may have gone there, but the planes of existence are different. And Sataputta is trying his best to explain in scientific terminology how it all makes sense. The idea that human beings didn't write the scripture is pretty much current in every religious tradition. That's exactly what the authors, what conservative people consider of the Bible. They think the authors were inspired. Some say they were inspired. Some say that every word was inspired. Now, what is our position? What do we say? What do we say? Prabhupada said, Krishna sat next to me and dictated. That means every word. No error. Flawless. No mistake. No illusion. No imperfect senses. No cheating. That is not the way that modern-day scholarship would view it. They'd say that this is the product of human beings who were imperfect, illusioned, had a propensity to cheat. And that's what they'll say. They made mistakes. And the mistakes are now being proven by discoveries in modern science. So don't take it literally. Take it symbolically. Just like the creation story, they just feel you can't take that literally. You can't take it literally. That God made man and then he took Adam's rib and made Eve. Do you really believe that? Do we believe that? Yes or no? Now, some people say no, but then how do we believe? What do we believe? You think that what we believe is any more apparently fantastic, that Brahma stood there and from his head, from his thought process, so many human beings were created. And those human beings were married and then they produced what? Progeny. What kind of progeny?
Different varieties of species.
Well, is that any different than Adam's rib becoming Eve? It's a little bit more far out. At least one human came from another human. Here we have animals and plants and birds coming from humans. And there's definitely no scientific evidence of that. So we have to find a way to explain this if we expect a reasonable people, intelligent people, to buy this. Now, on the other hand, if we don't consider these things, if we just accept them on face value, then there's no problem. But that is not what is being done today in the academic world. They don't do that. They read with a critical eye. Someone was saying to me the other day, one professor was saying, that the academy has to be methodologically agnostic. Methodologically agnostic. If they're theist, then they're prejudiced. And if they're atheist, that's also a bias. So the academy is methodologically agnostic. Agnostic means I don't know, which is basically what is done in the academy. You ask questions without any assumptions. I don't know. Prove it with evidence. Because since the Enlightenment, everything has to have evidence, not just on faith. As soon as we talk of pure faith, then it's possible to be, they would say, theistic. So they have to be, you know, methodological. Their method is agnosticism. I don't know. Prove it. So, we may not confront, most of us may not have occasion to confront these types of circumstances. But we should be aware that this is going on in the intellectual community of the world. And for our movement to be accepted seriously by the intellectual community, we're going to have to respond to these issues. We can respond from on a social level with a community that works, and that will convince many people. We can respond, you know, on a purely musical or food level with our restaurants and kirtans, and that will work. But if we want to respond in terms of theology, of philosophy, then we have to deal with these issues. And to a great extent, religion has failed to give a satisfying response to date. And that's why one of two things has happened. Either people have become irreligious, non-religious, or in a sense of institutional religion, they have given up religion, or they have changed religion. Now we're going to have to decide what's going to happen. Either we're going to hold to our position, but be able to explain it in a way that nobody else has been able to do with their own religions, or we're going to have to adjust our religion, or people are just going to lose respect for our religion, or not gain respect. So this is it is a challenge. Very big challenge. And I think Prabhupada recognized the extent of that challenge when he gave so much importance to the BI. Because he recognized that if we can't stand up against science in their own terms, practically, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to convince very intelligent people to join this movement. Now, someone may join this movement out of frustration, that I just feel the material world is so unpleasant. And that, I think that's a reason to become a member of ISKCON. That I just feel happier here, whatever the philosophy may or may not be. And I think you could make a stand for that. But at the same time, it would help to be able to respond intelligently. In the purport, Prabhupada speaks about regulative principles and restrictions, and these are called vidhi, vaidhi, sadhana, bhakti. And Prabhupada says that a person who follows regulative principles is like a patient. A patient is not allowed to just do anything and everything. A patient is restricted. So in the conditioned stage, we have to restrict ourselves. And that's what the morning program is all about. Some of you are not very strict about the morning programs. That means you are patients who are not prepared yet to get fully over your illness. If we follow the idea of this analogy. liberated persons, they don't have to be under such regulative principles. However, generally, they follow these regulative principles just to set an example for others. That means even the topmost devotee will still follow sadhana bhakti, just to teach others by his example. Because whatever great persons do, all the world follows their example. Now, what is it that great persons do? Prabhupada says that they take pleasure in describing the transcendental activities of the Lord. The Lord's activities are transcendental. His attributes are transcendental. That means he's a person with form, qualities. And these are not material. Again, the impersonalists will argue, oh, as soon as you talk of form, you're talking of matter. No. Krishna's body is satchit ananda vigraha, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. We also have an eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss body, potentially. But at the present moment, because our consciousness is mundane, we have this material body, this gross body. We see a distinction. This is called dualism, a distinction between the body and the soul. That's not very popular today amongst philosophers. They're not into dualism anymore. But we have a different understanding, as I said, a chinta-veda-veda-tattva. It's not totally dualistic. It's one and different simultaneously. That's very popular. If we explain these things with popular terminology, it should go over very well. Dualism is out. The body-mind distinction, they don't want to see that. They want to see that because biology has, you know, demonstrated that when you go down to very fine levels, it's difficult to make out distinctions, even between different species, for example. So it's very hard now to maintain the philosophy that only a human being has a soul. Because biologically, we find that there's not all that much different between a human and an animal in terms of how they're sentient and how, you know, the level of consciousness certainly is different. A human being can be self-conscious in a way that an animal cannot. So someone could say that's the soul. But we have... our philosophy has great potential, if it's used, to speak now to the Western world and give answers which, you know, traditional Judeo-Christian theology cannot do without serious adjustment. We're not going to be able to adjust our philosophy. Prabhupada was very clear about that. Neither do I think that we need to. I think that our Vedic sages were so highly intelligent that they gave us a theology which actually is now being proven by material science, by modern science. In other words, modern science is now coming to the point of the conclusions of what the Vedas talked about thousands of years ago. They're coming up to us. But unless we can expose our philosophy and explain our philosophy with proper terminology, that will not be, we can just say it, but it won't be proven. So some persons have to take up that challenge. Very important challenge. If we, again, as I say, if we want to gain the respect and admiration of the, you know, learned persons. And Prabhupada was quite concerned about the learned persons. Prabhupada sent me a telegram in Bombay once. You speak if mass, I speak if class. That's what the telegram said. It was coming from Australia. I was in Bombay, he said, you speak if mass, I speak if class. You know, and he took time to meet with these scholars, didn't he? And he made his books always with the idea that they should be appreciated by the scholarly class of persons. So they take pleasure, transcendentals do, in discussing Krishna, because Krishna is not of this world. But they take pleasure in a way, as Prabhupada did, not just the speaking of another world. Listen to a lecture of Prabhupada. He speaks on so many topics. He relates this world constantly to Krishna. How expert are we in relating this world to Krishna? Can you relate your own life to Krishna? That's another important challenge. Not to see dualism. Oh, I'm a devotee while I'm in this room. I feel myself to be a devotee when I'm chanting on my beads. But when I go out and do my other work, I sort of, you know, what do? I change my clothes. That changing of clothes is very symbolic, isn't it? It is very symbolic. When you take off your dhoti or sari and put on the other clothes, it's a symbol of something. Now, if it's only a change of clothes, fine. But if it becomes more than that, there's a big problem. How do we adjust, or how do we connect all of our daily activities to the chanting, to being a devotee? If we can't, then we're leading a type of, you know, schizophrenic life. That's not very satisfying or going to be very convincing. I think when Prabhupada lectured, we see that he spoke on many subjects. He did not simply speak on Krishna's pastimes in the spiritual sky, because he saw that that spiritual sky is to be extended everywhere. Prabhupada spoke about making the world Krishna conscious. Not just, you know, this temple room. This temple room undoubtedly is very beautiful. But now, if I was to go into your home, will it be equally nice? If I go to your workplace, will it be equally nice? If I look, or if any one of us looks into any aspect of the other person's life, will we feel that it is Krishna conscious? We have to be able to make everything so Krishna conscious that there is nothing but Krishna consciousness in our existence. That is a unified way of living. That kind of a philosophy is going to convince people. Otherwise, if you tell people, I'm just like you, except when I come and pray in the temple, that's not going to be convincing. You have to be able to show that your philosophy works for you 24 hours a day. You have to be able to live your philosophy 24 hours a day. Now, for those of you who are pujaris, well, great. You can do it a lot easier. But Prabhupada didn't exactly give, you know, that the priority of all activities, did he? He said you can close the temple room, lock the doors to go out in Sankirtan, for example. He didn't seem to indicate. I mean, just like in Los Angeles, we had one pujari and 59 Sankirtan devotees. And Prabhupada thought it was a great temple. He stayed 9 months in a row there. He said, this is the model. That's why when I hear people say, I want to be a pujari instead of being a Sankirtan devotee, I just think, you don't understand anything about the mind of the spiritual master. You understand zero. Because that was not Prabhupada's mood. He said you could lock the doors to go out in Sankirtan. Prabhupada wanted to change the world. And I'm not talking about minimizing the deity's service. I'm talking about the fact that if we only think about the deity and don't think about the fact that the other living beings in the world have to be made Krishna conscious, we are no better than kanistas, by definition. A kanista adhikari is one who cannot see the Lord in the heart of every living being. There has to be a very strong mood of relating or offering Krishna consciousness to others. And the Sankirtan devotees are doing this. Sankirtan devotee, but it's not just a Sankirtan devotee. I mean to say, anyone can do this. Just like I'm trying to do that where I go. When I go to school, I try to do that. And people see, this is a devotee. They had to, you know, when they, I went to one awards ceremony, the, you know, the, all of the top officials in the school, they had to wrestle with this name, Tamal Krishna Goswami. They had to say it. They had to deal with that. They had to deal with me, in my robes, with my tilak. Now, it would be very nice if everybody could go in their robes, in their self, and the hell with the rest of the world. I don't think that's the way Prabhupada lectured. Certainly, Prabhupada was a topmost transcendentalist. But Prabhupada spoke on many subjects to teach us that everything has its connection with Krishna. Certainly, we want to also talk of Krishna exclusively. We do that in the form of Krishna book. We do that in the form of our kirtans. We do that in the form of our chanting of japa. And there should be taste, increasing taste, when we do these activities. When we chant japa, nothing else should be in our minds. And when we read Krishna book and read the pastimes of the Lord, we should be absorbed. And when we see the deity, we should be highly absorbed. But at the same time, we have to be soldiers for Krishna. We have to be able to relate the world to Krishna consciousness. So, one who takes pleasure in describing the glories of the Lord, which is what the text says, means everything about Krishna. Everything about Krishna. Not just Krishna Lila. That too, but not just Krishna Lila. But how everything can be seen in relationship to Krishna. That, according to Chaitanya Chaitamrita, is Krishna consciousness. He sees so many things, but he does not exactly see the things. He sees them in relationship to Krishna. So we have to develop that vision. We have to develop that philosophy to such a degree that we can convince people that here is the perfect philosophy. Here is the perfect lifestyle. Here's where you should be. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Narada.
Shri, in the beginning of the class you were mentioning about seeing spirit and matter, and then later you brought up these points. And my question is that for a devotee who's practicing Krishna consciousness, say as a full-time member within our society, so you were mentioning that perhaps that person would become out of touch with matter or understanding matter, or you made some distinction there.
No, I did. I didn't say what you just said. I definitely did not say what you said. You can say what you said, but don't say that I said that.
And my question is, how is it that the devotee is out of touch with matter, or like taking a break, so to speak, from? Is it just that they're not preaching?
No, you misunderstood me. I was not referring to the devotees when I said that. I was referring to persons who claim that that everything is spirit. Just like so many pseudo-spiritualists, you know, who you meet and they say, you know, it's all so spiritual, everything is so spiritual, sex is spiritual. That's what I was referring to. I wasn't talking about the devotees. You're talking about something else. What I was talking about were people who just say everything is spirit, or like them, I used the example also of the impersonalists in some religious organization who opens high, everything is spirit, but they can't live on that level. That's what I was talking about. Now you're talking about something else, so you can, let's talk about what you're talking about. Now repeat what you're talking about, but don't repeat it as if it's something that I said before.
My question then would be...
it's a new question, in other
words. New question.
Okay.
My question would be, is it, if we're not progressing somehow, for example, like you're doing now with the university studies, and we're more focused on, say, the temple activities and so forth, you know, is that somehow a hindrance? In other words, how do we expand from the position, say, of a temple devotee and so forth.
Well, I hope I'm a temple devotee. I don't think of myself not being a temple devotee. You have to go shopping. Do you put on your karmic clothes to go shopping? You have to do the laundry out there. You have to put on when you go to the laundromat. What do you wear? How do you deal with people? Do you have two identities or one? I don't believe anybody can live in isolation anymore. I don't think we do live in isolation.
Someone might say that I put on my street clothes, I put on my civilian clothes because I don't want to force my religion upon people. They become.
Who told you to force them? Who said you should force them? You mean to say that wearing what you want forces someone to do something? I don't believe that. If you mean to say that your philosophy is that whatever you'd like me to be, I'll be. Since you don't like to see me in my devotional clothing, I'll wear karmic clothing. Since you don't like to see that I'm a vegetarian, I'll go out and eat meat with you. Where does that end? I don't believe that. That's not our philosophy. Just like Rupa Nuga, he goes to school, but he doesn't go in a dhoti. Now, what would happen if you went in a dhoti? You see, you never thought that you could have done that, but you could have done that. You could have done it. I did it. Now it may be difficult to change, but you could have done it. A lot of us could do a lot more than we are doing, but we just assume, oh, it's easier to merge. It's easier to blend in. But then we lose such an opportunity. What an opportunity. They've got a Hare Krishna. When I submit my application to this university I go to, they had to submit an essay. My essay was a Hare Krishna at SMU. That was the title of it. From the very moment I stepped foot in that, I even asked my professor, I said, do you think it would be better? He said, that would be very strange if you didn't wear your robes. You're a Hare Krishna. Hare Krishnas wear robes and shave their heads. And immediately they'll have to have respect if you do the work first class. If you're not planning to be a student, don't wear robes or saris. That's another matter. You don't have to be an A student, but I mean to say, if you can do very well and you wear that, then they just think, well, okay. Yes? Yes, very highly elevated personalities. And then what do? After they see everything as spirit, what do? Shamsuna. Very highly elevated personalities who see everything as spirit, what do? Huh? That's the wrong answer. Let's see, someone else. Shamsuna, you know the answer? Rasha, you know the answer?
They come down to the level of seeing man as spirit.
Ah, that's right. They come from that platform back to the material, not material, to the Madhyam platform. They come from Uttama to Madhyam, and they make distinctions. If they did that, only see everything as spirit, what would happen? Why won't they be able to preach? And what other reason? What other reason? No, but what other reason? The other reason is that then, if they keep acting on that platform, what will happen? Huh? They've set the wrong example. A transcendentalist makes no distinction between man and woman. Now, but you can just see, Sukadeva Goswami, no distinction. When he went out naked, the girls did not cover themselves. As soon as Vyasa went out, the girls covered themselves because he was making distinction. He was a grihastha, they could understand. Therefore, now the next question comes, how will you know who is advanced and who is not advanced? Now, this is another important point. This is a pretty important point. There's two points. One, that this philosophy, this our movement, our process ties together a person's spiritual advancement and their philosophy or their ability to speak and understand the philosophy. In other words, we do not make a distinction, you know, between religion and theology. We are not armchair theologians who sit there and come up with this incredible scheme while smoking cigars. Pipes, sorry about that. You know, some maybe smoking a pipe, but they're still doing the same thing either way. Smoking a pipe, thank you. A better image of them. We tie together. We say that, this is very difficult. The experiment that we demand that someone perform is on themselves, which is really problematic, isn't it, for a scientist? Because you're supposed to bracket yourself out of the picture. And yet here, it's you have to be subjective and objective at the same time. If you don't subjectively involve yourself in the experiment of Krishna consciousness, you won't get the realization about Krishna that you need to have. But then you have to objectify it by explaining it as if you're neutral. Otherwise, someone else who's not a faithful person will not believe it or understand it. We tie the two together, in any case. You have to practice. You have to experience. You cannot just intellectually grasp. That's called mental speculation. So, advancement. What was the point we were talking about? Advanced persons. No, but there was something else that was said. Yes, Chaitanya? What are the symptoms of an advanced person? Yes, yes. That they no longer hanker for material things. You see, we place so much of a priority on experience, on experiential realization. We do not just place, you know, priority on a philosophy that can intellectually explain reality. If you can't control your senses, then you're an animal. No matter how highfalutin what you say sounds. That's Prabhupada's point. You're just a dog. You're a debased animal. Because your senses are out of control. But what's the use of your philosophy? Your behavior shows that you're an animal. Okay, you've learned how to talk. Well, someone was saying that they have little parrots now, that you can train a parrot, you know, to have, they train parrots to do a whole drama. Where was I reading that? Reading it or hearing it? Someone was saying how, it was in that book that Dan gave me. That the Queen of Jaipur, Maharani of Jaipur, was saying that when she grew up, they used to have in India, they had trained parrots that would put on an entire drama. Because they could speak all the words on cue, and they would do everything. They'd have a little cannon that would go off, and they'd blow off the cannon, and everybody would be frightened except the parrots by the sound, because they knew, you know, the whole drama by the parrots. Why parrots? Machines, robots are incredible. Now robots have been developed to such a degree, computer robots, that you know that they're humanoids. People have come up with it now, I mean, just to show you how far out things are going, you know. Traditionally, religion has always said that, you know, the human beings, the souls, are eternal. So now they have a new idea of eternity. That since the human race will eventually become extinct, like every other species, because there'll be a freezing, you know, eventually the universe will freeze, and all kinds of sentient life will end, right? But they will transfer the software of the human brain. That means our human, you know, software into a computer. And a computer will not be affected by the temperatures changes. And so there will be a type of, you know, eternity, a type of eternity experience. The human software, the human qualities will be eternalized in the software of the computer, and the computer will continue to exist. At least it will extend it on and on, way beyond our human extinction. And this will be a type of eternity. And the author of the book was trying to give this as an example of how we could still feel satisfied, that, you know, and meaningful, even though we've realized that one day we'll be extinct. I tell you, see where things are going. We don't come out with our Krishna conscious philosophy. This is all that people have to chew on.
But your point about not being an armchair philosopher but living the philosophy, your answer though to the agnosticism of the religious
methodological agnosticism.
Yeah, because once you have the experience, then you will be a theist. You will no longer be an agnostic.
But at least their point is that in the academy, you should be agnostic.
In your methodology.
In other words, you can't presume that someone... You can't take God as a given. You can't take the soul. You cannot begin with the soul as a given. You see, we sit down here to give a class, and there's a lot of presumptions. This is not a university classroom. Everybody accepts that God exists, that God is on the altar, that his name is Krishna, that the name of God is non-different than God, that we are the soul, that this body is... I mean, there's a lot of givens here. You can't go into a university with any of those givens. At least in the academy, that's the rules they want to play by. That's tough. Those are tough rules to play by. And you can say, but the rules themselves are biased. But they'll say, no, we're not going to be atheists. We don't say there is no God. We don't say Krishna is not the name of God. We just say, I don't know. So who can ever can make a better case, that is going to go win the day. Now make your case. Without any givens. That's hard, isn't it? May not become convinced.
They won't become convinced unless they get the case, no matter what case you make for them.
Well, but Prabhupada said, he did not accept that as an answer. He said, no, the BI should explain our philosophy in scientific terms. He said you should outdo them in their intellectual game.
But now Prabhupada was able to convince Bhakti Subhadamadhar Maharaj or other scientists.
But Bhakti Subhadamadhar Maharaj was from Manipur. I mean, he started out with a pretty... He had a head start.
Right, so he didn't have to be convinced.
I don't think he had to be
convinced. But he had to be convinced by Prabhupada. Now this is your mission, to go out there and convince the scientists.
That he had to do.
And therefore that little book, I don't know if it still is published, the scientific basis...
No, I have that book.
So popular, at least in India, was the top most selling book?
Yes. Lalita Krishna Prabhu.
Krishna said there are all kinds of people who surrender to him and form the door. So obviously you have the faithful and the faithless.
Yeah, they are.
But what is the point of preaching the faithless?
What is the point? To make ourselves more faithful, perhaps? Prabhupada preached to the faithless people. Who did Prabhupada preach to? He did preach a lot to these Maya Pritiganis. There's lots of videos of him preaching to scholars. He did preach to them. He talked about using their reviews all the time to sell his books. He was most satisfied when a standing order would go into a university of his books, a standing order of his books. But it's quite a challenge. It's a lot easier to preach to the persons who are pious than the persons who are impious. You're right. I don't say it's for everyone to do. And it may not be nearly as rewarding in an immediate sense as going out and holding a big Hare Krishna festival in Poland. You know, where the whole population are pious believers, poor. I mean, you've got a lot of things going for you in Poland. You know, they like to sing, they like to dance, they like to eat, they believe in God, they're poor, and they're not satisfied with their own religion. And that's a surefire formula for success. I mean, what do you got here? You know, in North Dallas, on a campus? Well, they're not poor. And as far as religion goes, the religions that they have are a way to further money and social life. They certainly don't believe in a God that their parents believed in, so if they still believe, it's a different God. And singing and dancing is certainly not something you do in religion. Although nowadays evangelists are getting popular. It's a harder field. It's a more difficult field. But this is the field that Prabhupada focused on. He didn't focus on Poland. He focused on the United States. And the world is focused on the United States. Yeah, I don't remember the exact quote, but I'll just take it on faith that what you said is one thing he said. One thing you have to realize is that Prabhupada did say many things. So if you hold on to only one thing he said, you can often get a unbalanced conclusion. Because Prabhupada did say many things. For example, when I was in Bombay, do you know what he told me was my job as the GBC? To collect more than anybody else there. That's what he told me. So there's a lot of things Prabhupada said, but I also think the Prabhupada said, I would agree with you, the Prabhupada also said, the GBC should take care of the devotees and encourage them. But he said different things to different people at different times. But it seems to me that the greatest number of devotees are no longer in this movement. That's another point to consider. Here we have done pretty well in Texas. Most of the people who have joined, I think to a great extent, are we are doing much better than most places. Most of them are still in the movement. Or they've moved to other parts of the movement. But around ISKCON, 90% of the people, or 80% of the people, aren't in this movement any longer. Now what about all those people? And they're still devotees of Krishna. They still believe in Krishna as God. Most of them are still vegetarians. They still respect Prabhupada. But they're not connected to ISKCON very closely. Now, what about them?
Many of them want to make the ISKCON leaders the scapegoat for their mind.
And to some extent, they may be right. I wouldn't say that the ISKCON leaders can be totally exonerated from any blame, but it's certainly not the only cause. There are many causes. Now, someone burns something in the kitchen. They don't put the exhaust fan on, you know. The cooks never put the exhaust fan on. There's something burning in the oven that's not the prasadam, but the... And the deities have to smell this. Well, all right, we have spoken for beyond an hour. Today is my beginning of my big vacation. Now I can just take it easy and answer the 200 letters that I haven't answered. Write 3 papers. And do all the other things. Vacation means double work. I hope that you don't feel that I neglect the people here. But if you do feel that way, yeah. I try to give everybody a little attention. But I have decided that I want to go on the front lines again. Because for so many years I was on the back line encouraging everybody else. Now I want to go on the front line and fight. And that's what I'm going to do. Because I'm tired of being behind everybody and letting you all have all the fun. I want to have some fun now too. I want to fire the gun. And people told me that that's what our leaders should also do. Otherwise, what is the meaning of being a leader if you're not leading out the charge? I was having dinner the other day, and I told Leela that my brother was coming to town. She said, "You have a brother?" I said, "Yeah, I have a mother also." I didn't just fall out of the spiritual world, Leela, you know. I have a father and a mother. She said, "But I didn't know you had a brother." I said, "I have a brother." She said, "I didn't know that. You never talk about it." So he's coming here, and you will meet him. He's a very nice person named Carl. He's a professor of English in Iowa. We've only seen each other a couple times in the last 30 years or so. Haven't seen each other very much. But somehow just by knowing that I became a devotee, he became a devotee. He chants, he and his wife, he's got 3 kids, they chant, take prasadam, and so he's coming for a little association. And I would only request that when you see him, he'll be staying at Radha Vinod's house. Please give him your friendship and association, encouragement. While he's here, he'll be here till Wednesday. So I haven't been with him much more than any of you have, like I say. I've only seen him, I've seen him twice in 30 years. See, I was very fanatic. I have never gone to my parents' home since the day I became a devotee. I refused to go. Now, in my old age, or my mother's old age, I've agreed that the next time I come through where she is, I will go to her home. But I never would. I always insisted, if you want to come to see me, come to the temple.
Did you ever put on karmic clothes again?
Well, the only time I've ever done that was to when I had to go behind the bamboo curtain. Because there was no alternative. Otherwise, I've tried not to. And I think we can wear devotee clothing a lot more than we do. I mean, Prabhupada did not object to devotees wearing non-devotional clothing. Sometimes you have to do that. You won't get a job or you won't be able to hold a job. But when we can, we should.
On Sankirtan, do you recommend doing
that? Well, Prabhupada seemed to think that it was all right if it would help you to sell books. In other words, whatever will sell the books most easily is what we should do. So that's why we don't wear our devotional clothing in the sankirtan. Okay, we're doing a sankirtan marathon, right, ladies? Mostly ladies. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Huh?
Solar eclipse.
Oh, Prajapati says it will be a good day for book distribution. There'll be no light out. You can reach into their back pockets and steal them blind during the solar eclipse. Remember, when there's a solar eclipse, don't look. Not supposed to look, right, Nilamana? Kunkumagi? You got to ask the Hindus this question, huh? Not supposed to see? What happens? And what about this? Today is a solar eclipse. The sun is being blocked today, not the moon. What time?
I don't know if it'd be enough to see.
I'm going to be in a conference today. They're a very interesting conference I'm going to. One of the scholars is presenting a paper on the program of Drudha Karma. And Shataputta was on ABC television. Yeah, so the scholar is critiquing our critique of it. I'll let you know what they say, but I have a feeling it isn't going to be good. All right, Jai. Sankirtan Yagniki.